First, before we start talking about Queer and the reprints of Junkie and the Exterminator, I'll ask you a couple of questions about where are we exactly? Why is this place called the Bunker?
Oh, this is simply a loft that I rented, I think, first in 1975. And I lived here for just about 3 years. James lived here about 6 months before me, and it's one of the more satisfactory places I've ever, locations I've ever had.
Boy, you've got plenty of room.
Well, room, quiet. Mm-hmm. See, there's no noise in here. You don't get any street sounds. Those walls are 3 feet thick. This is an old building.
What was it before?
It was YMCA at one time. And then I think it was some photograph, x-ray photograph, because I wasn't able to figure out exactly what those were used for, but I rather imagine to hang photographs, those bolts.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, they're all through the house. Of course, the YMCA, there are two urinals in there that go back to the YMCA days and even some graffiti.
That's the urinals, very handy.
Well, they were out of commission for a long time.
Ah. So this is
still... Just purely decorative. I think they got them working again now.
This is still your place, though.
No. Yes, I officially own the rights that there are only leases on these apartments. But I have turned it over to John Juno. See, he also lives in the building. He has a smaller room upstairs on the street, and it's very convenient for him to have this space where he can be quiet and work and rehearse, and also he conducts rehearsals out there.
What does he do exactly?
Oh, he just dials up poems. He gives readings, and he also issues records. The dial-up poem series, the journal series. Yeah, and they're quite impressive. This has been going on for years. I'm sure we have some of them around. They have very good covers.
Do you do any work here anymore?
No, I live in Kansas.
Right.
But if I come here, I come here for business.
So really. When you come here, it's not a matter of working in the, here in the... You call it the Bunker, is that right?
Yes, it is. It's a very good place.
I see it has iron bars.
It's very good, yes. Well, the question you build, it's a very good place, actually, in the event of a nuclear attack, as good as any.
Well, we can hope.
It's also a very secure building. Yeah. You have these doors between me and the street, and the people downstairs. There's a furniture store downstairs, and they sort of keep an eye on people going in and out.
Well, as I recall, the last time we chatted, it was on the occasion of the place of Dead Roads.
Ah, yes.
And that was a year or two ago. And what have you been doing with yourself since I saw you last?
Well, I'm keeping very busy. I'm well into the next novel in the trilogy, which will be called The Western Lands, although I may change that. Western Lands is Egyptian paradise, no reference to the Old West.
Oh, references, yes,
but not direct. And I've been working on that. I've completed a cat book, which is now completed.
I'm sorry.
I've completed a cat book.
A cat book?
Yes, which is now, the text is finished. And the real, one of the principal purposes of this visit is to talk to a possible production people here for an illustrated edition. And I go over to Paris and talk to Brian, who's illustrating the book. He's done quite a bit of artwork, but I know he's doing some more, so.
Now, what kind of cat book is this that you've written, or are writing?
It is a cat book called The Cat Inside. The theme is animal contact, not communication. Very distinct line between communication and contact. Since communication requires, must preserve a distance across which communication can take place. So it's the contrary of contact. The point of communication is to keep people away or whatever, not to get close. And that animal contact, or any contact, it's sure to be very painful. Not really, because you're coming in contact with painful material.
I presume this is a nonfiction book.
Oh, yes, well, call it that.
It would be your first nonfiction, won't it?
Oh, good heavens, no, I've written books of essays.
Essays, yes.
That's and also, the line between fiction and nonfiction is a very thin one.
You,
it's in fact, non-existent.
You engaged in an interesting arrangement with Viking and Penguin, and they have you signed to a multi-book arrangement, and the first in the series is Queer. Queer is a book. I don't know if you can call it a book. I guess the way Viking describes it is a fragment of a manuscript that you wrote, I guess, after Junkie. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yes.
Tell me a little bit about why Queer has languished unread all these years and is suddenly out in a published form.
Oh, well, it's been a manuscript. It was a manuscript. I didn't think much of it and didn't. We made one effort to publish it with Ace, the people who published Junkie, and they said, oh, no, we'd be in jail if we published this. Shows you how things have changed. And then it was among my papers to which I attached no value or importance. I didn't realize that manuscripts had any value in those days. That would be about the time that Naked Lunch came out. However, Brian Dyson carefully preserved these manuscripts, among which was the manuscript of Queer. Mm-hmm. There were several, I think there were more than one, I'm not sure. But at any rate, I was paying no attention. And then we sold the entire archive to someone named Badoon. Is it working?
Yeah, it's working. I'm sorry, you sold the archive to whom?
Roberto Altman in Vaduz. And now it's recently been acquired and transferred to this country. But we don't know the final destination.
How did Viking obtain the manuscript in order to print it? Where did they get the manuscript?
It says here, and that's about all I'd really say on this rather controversial subject. With grateful acknowledgement of the kind cooperation of Robert H. Jackson and for his aid in the publication of this book.
So he has the original manuscript, indeed.
He has the original. He owns the original.
All right, well, let's talk a little bit about the events leading up to Queer, which followed Junkie. And you have a very interesting introduction in Queer, in which you state that in 1949, you were in New Orleans when you were arrested for heroin and marijuana possession. Can you tell me a little bit about that incident? And
It's all in Junkie. I mean, I really, you know, to go over those incidents, I couldn't put any narrative flair into it. It's described very, very precisely in Junkie, the exact descriptions of the police, the detectives involved, and so on.
All right. After your arrest, you went to Mexico.
You were
in Mexico City, and this is the next phase after this arrest. And what did you decide as you stayed in Mexico?
Decide? Mm-hmm.
Did you decide to go back to New Orleans and face trial? Or what?
Oh, no. There was never any question of that. That was the purpose of my going to Mexico. I did not intend to face trial in New Orleans. And I called my lawyer. I had a lawyer in Mexico who said, if they ask extradition, we can block it indefinitely. I saw the judge and gave him some money, too. So, and I called my lawyer in New Orleans, and he said, well, just between you and me, I wouldn't come back. I got a tough judge here, and very down on drugs. His ulcers are bothering him. So, O'Hara, he was an Irish name. So then he said, but I don't think that they will be very interested in pursuing the case. That is, they did not ask for extradition, which means that the case is nulli proce, not proceeded with. So it's not a conviction.
Did you realize that by not going back to Mexico, it would be difficult for you to ever come back to the country, at least for an extended period of time?
Oh, no, that's not true. If the case is nulli proce and they haven't asked extradition, that pretty much means they've shit-canned it, as the police say.
Did that actually indeed happen?
Well, the nulli proce means put aside.
Did they do that?
Yes, they nulli proce the case.
But you decided to remain in Mexico.
I decided to remain. I thought it would be discreet to remain for a certain period of time, but there was never any question of it being that case being reopened.
You mentioned that that you didn't pay a bribe to an immigration official because they had arrested you potentially as an undesirable alien, presumably because of the drug arrest.
Oh, they were just putting a squeeze on that, so the way Mexicans will.
Junkie, of course, is your first novel. That was published by Ace, and you wrote that under the name William Lee, but it's very clear that you were writing about your own experiences, and as you said a moment ago, these early experiences with regard to drugs are expressed very well.
Yeah, very clearly. So probably,
Then we go on to Queer, and in the introduction to the book, you mention that you were motivated to write about Queer because of what?
Well, I don't know what motivated me. It was that was what I just described in the introduction, the fact that I wasn't really at all sure of my motivations. I don't think any writer is. All you can do is guess.
No, you state very specifically.
Said very specifically that that it was Joan's death, certainly. But I was thinking of the time sequence because some of this was written, I think a good deal of it was written before her death. I'm not sure of the timing. No, it couldn't have been. It couldn't have been written before her death, come to think of it.
Well, you state in the introduction to Queer that you would never have been a writer but for Joan's death.
I suggest that as a possibility, very much more, not quite as definitive. I make the comparison of Denton Welch and his accident, which turned him, made an invalid of him and turned him into a writer, which was his real talent, not pain. And say that he probably would not have become a writer except for this accident. It killed him finally 10 years later. And I was making that comparison. Now, as to how accurate that is, of course, in his case, it was a physical factor. Well, I say that's my feeling. It doesn't mean that it's 100%.
You got off to a very late start as a writer, didn't you?
Yes.
How old were you?
Thank God.
35. But
Conrad was the same age.
Pardon?
Conrad was the same age when he wrote "He Can Outcast the Islands" was his first book. Very definitely. Yes.
Of course, you had a lot of literary associations during this period, didn't you? You had an association with Ginsberg. Kerouac, you got encouragement from both?
Yes. But of course, that was later. Later for all of us.
Well,
in other words, it wasn't in the originally a group of writers at all, because none of them had actually published. And I didn't see myself as a writer. I sort of resisted the idea.
But William Burroughs, Allen Ginsberg, he has an introduction in the reprint of Junkie, and he goes into some detail about how he tried to help you to sell this book.
Oh, yes. Oh, heavens, yes. Yeah, he also was instrumental in the publication of Naked Lunch. He placed these excerpts in the Chicago Review. And then there was another book of excerpts from Dahlberg, Kerouac, and myself, Big Table. And the trustees wouldn't allow them to publish, and they resigned and founded Big Table. When Maurice Duryodhia heard about this in Paris, he decided he wanted to publish Naked Lunch. He'd seen the manuscript, but didn't quite like it first time through. So he said, well, I want to publish it in 2 weeks. So there were massive notes, about 600 pages or more of notes, which overflowed into the subsequent books. We assembled, that is, Brian, Alan, various people helping me with the typing, got it together in 2 weeks, and that was the manuscript of Naked Lunch. The only substantial change was that I originally had the scene of the two detectives in the beginning, and we changed that to the end, but otherwise the order in which it came from the printer, which was purely arbitrary, as we'd finished the section, we'd send it to the printer thinking, well, we'll make the proper sequence later. But the way it just came off the press seemed to be just as it should be, yes. Jane. Chain of circumstances when I despaired of publication.
Better get back on the microphone before you talk.
I just said that was a remarkable turn of fortunate circumstances. You see, I really despaired of publication of Naked Lunch. Made a number of unsuccessful attempts. I believe Stephen Spender said, having waded through the yaws and yaws of entrails, I prefer my pleasures outdoors or some such. They weren't content with just simple rejection slips, in other words. Well, suddenly out of nowhere, to have it a month later out on the stands, he sent someone over from his office, Sinclair Bayliss, in fact, whom I knew, said he wants to publish the manuscript in 2 weeks, wants to have the completed manuscript. So it was really an extraordinary run of luck. A run of luck that was initiated by Allen Ginsberg sending these sections off the Big Table.
Now, in the Viking Penguin reprint of Junkie, they are stating that for the first time, this is the first complete and unexpurgated edition of Junkie. Now, I had not read the first edition, so I wasn't able to make a direct side-by-side comparison. But I'd like to know what are the differences. Was the original version of Junkie that was printed expurgated?
Oh, there was very small things. Like, this is not the consensus of medical opinion. Or those sort of annotations, for the most part. Very small changes, about 20 of them. There's one chapter that they didn't put in the original edition, not because there was anything scandalous in it, because there was nothing about junk in it. That was the chapter about the Rio Grande Valley. So it really is, it arouses expectations in the reader that will certainly be disappointed because the changes are very, very small. Oh, yes, you bastards instead of you motherfuckers. No, wait a minute. Oh, that's a good scene, you see, the way it worked. She handed me the package or something and said, get out of here, you're both motherfuckers. And I said, it was said very matter-of-factly, as if referring to actual incest. And they changed that, of course, in the eighth edition to you're both bastards, which meant nothing. Well, little things like that, a sentence here, a sentence there.
Well, as I read...
Cutting out profanity.
As I read Queer and as I read Junkie, I was tantalated by the fact that these are unexpurgated versions, but in the context of our literature today, there is nothing in either book that could conceivably be termed objectionable in terms of either language.
Yes, but you're thinking the present time and the tremendous changes in censorship since then. Those were the days when you couldn't say shit on a page, and they. People had all these euphemisms like frigging or
fugging.
Fugging or just blanks.
You still can't use those words on the radio, though.
No, I know that, yeah.
We have to bleep those. Well, that's
sure.
That's because we have bleep. Adults listening.
Yeah.
You know, you reckon I have a 17-year-old kid, and I've followed his progress for a number of years now, and you recognize that children, young kids, use the blatant language more than grown-ups. They know the words and they use them. And I think they shock their parents sometimes because of their use of profanity. But it seems to be the way people talk today.
Well, there are whole groups of people, like the whole lower classes in England, that use them for punctuation. It doesn't mean anything. I was walking down the friggin' street and sees a friggin' broad, and then took her over into the park where we had sexual intercourse. You see, there it's getting dirty. But the use of profanity for publication, for punctuation, it is very effective punctuation. I always hate to have God damn, toned down to God darn, or something absurd like that.
In Junkie, was the prologue in the original version? Or is this prologue specifically for the new Viking version?
I think this is the same. Wait a minute, let me be sure. Because there have been several reprints. So I just can't be sure whether it was for this edition.
But it wasn't for the Ace edition, was it?
Oh, wait a minute. Yes, this was in the Ace.
It was in the Ace edition?
Sure it was. Oh, yes. Yes. I didn't think there was anything deleted. They're always putting in these little medical notes. This is not the opinion of recognized medical authorities.
No. You state in Queer that you have never regretted your experiences with drugs. Can you talk to me about that? Why is this?
Well, in the first place, it's very stupid to ever regret anything. It's been very fruitful in many ways. I've gotten so many great ideas from cannabis. I mean, I just the sparkle picks up. Say I'm writing a dull article, and maybe I take a few hits, and there's suddenly a sparkle. It wasn't there before. Now, ideally, of course, you wouldn't need something to get the sparkle. There's evidence that say that the level of anxiety has risen terrifically in the last 50 or 60 years. Now, doses of cannabis, it used to be a regular prescribed medicine, and it was prescribed for nervousness, loss of appetite, depression. In other words, just for the monotony of life. And people took it just as we do to get high. The point is, they needed minute doses compared with people of the present time. Of course, if ideally, you wouldn't need any drugs. But we are, should we say, just about as far from being ideal as we possibly could be.
Do you still use cannabis to get a sparkle when you write?
From time to time, yes, certainly.
You said it's stupid not to regret anything, or to regret anything.
Yes,
stupid,
absolutely.
But haven't there been incidents in your lives, in your life, that you have regretted?
Naturally, you regret them. Whereas, you know, it isn't doing any good. If you figure that chance.
You mean to dwell over them, or to constantly remind yourself of things that you have regretted?
Not your name. Edward Arlington Robinson, a very underrated poet. Familiar as an old mistake and futile as regret. And another one, there are mistakes too monstrous for remorse, to tamper or to dally with.
Well,
and anyone who hasn't made mistakes like that just hasn't been around. You know, a young doctor never killed a patient. You got a lot to learn.
I don't want you to think I'm being argumentative, but with regard to your drug addiction, and, where you say you had many great ideas, and you certainly have as a result, but wasn't that also inhibiting in terms of personal relationships and your ability just to get through life?
Oh, well, no, because it's much easier to get through life with junk than without it, because you're immune to all sorts of annoyances, such as cold and boredom, etc. It was terribly insulating, obviously. It's very insulating and anti-creative. However, it's part of a whole picture, and then when that, during withdrawal, you get extremely return of sensory impressions, hallucinatory vividness. So it's like anything, you have to pay for things in different coinages.
Well, William Burroughs, I noticed in looking around the bunker here that I don't know if all of these are your objects, but I see there's some Japanese spike and chain set or something.
Oh, yes, that's, I would never use that bloody thing myself. I'd end up slapping myself in the face.
It looks dangerous.
More dangerous to the user than me.
There's a billy club there.
Oh, yes.
A photograph of you on the wall. It looks like you're holding a huge blunderbuss.
I'm holding a flintlock out at the Darcy Country Place, which were carefully without their flints. She was terrified that someone would actually get one together and fire it.
Well, I see there's a container of gun oil there. You still have a fascination, a preoccupation with guns.
Weapons. Oh, yes, I have quite a collection. About 8 or 9 handguns, 2 shotguns, 3 rifles. I don't hunt, though.
Do you still have this collection?
Certainly. I don't hunt. I could never kill a deer. Could never kill a squirrel. They're too much like a cat. The only thing I can shoot are birds. And that's a lot of trouble. No, they're mostly just for recreational shooting.
Well, isn't it possible to get in trouble with those handguns?
How? I got to take them to the range and shoot. How am I going to get in trouble?
You have them in Kansas, I assume.
Yes, of course.
Because I don't think they're allowed in New York City.
No, you have to have all kinds of permits in New York. But they're not in Kansas, they're not here.
Well, to kind of wrap things up, William Burroughs, so we've been chatting now for half an hour, and you're busy at work on new books and new manuscripts. When do you find, what portion of the day is your most productive period? When do you like to work?
Mostly in the early afternoon. Well, the late morning, early afternoon.
What is a typical day for you? You're in Lawrence, Kansas.
Yes, well, there isn't any. If I'm going good, sometimes I have periods when I can't write at all. I have periods of writer's block when I can't write at all. This is one of the many hazards of the profession. So, well, if I'm going good, if the juice is flowing, as Hemingway put it, I'll get up probably 8 or 9, have breakfast, and get shaved, cleaned up, then start working 11 or 12, and work through until 4 or 5 in the afternoon.
I would say 4 or 5 hours at the typewriter is enough for any person. You work at a typewriter?
Always.
It's can be exhausting and emotionally draining, can't it, to sit there by
yourself? Well, it's not only it's emotionally draining, but it's also very stressful. Now, it's stressful without any way to relieve the stress. In other words, if you're taking part in a battle scene, you've got the adrenaline going with your, and abreacted by physical exertion. But if you're writing about it and feeling it very strongly, you'll get the adrenaline, but there's no way to abreact it because it's sedentary and stressful. That is why I think it takes such a toll of alcoholics.
Do you do any work with the students at the University of Kansas?
I taught I was a visiting writer in residence for one semester. I'd take over 4 classes and see students and stuff like that.
Did you like doing that?
I don't. I don't like teaching. But since there were only a few of these, they were sort of performances like a reading, and that wasn't too bad.
Are you technically a writer in residence at the University of Kansas?
No, I was for a semester.
Uh-huh. But you're still hanging your hat there, even though you're not technically working at the university?
No, not at all. No, I was hired as a writer in residence for one semester, so I had no status there at all.
But you must like the country, the area.
Well, it's very similar to the kind of country I was brought up in. Lots of trees, lots of water. I like heavily wooded areas.
And you're close to the World Series.
Never seen a baseball game in my life. Well, something I know absolutely nothing about. When people say
I saw one
about
once.
The Mets and the Yankees.
If you want to have a good topic for a novel, and you see a nightmare world, you can go up for a ball game at Yankee Stadium. It is the most frightening atmosphere you've ever seen. There are people there. They are, if you talk about drug addicts, these are violent drug addicts and drunks. Some of them are carrying big radios. You're trying to watch a ball game and they play these big radios. And it is scary. Scary to go up there. And I went up to the Yankee Stadium once and I thought, gosh, this is supposed to be America's sport. And we go there and you see all of these people who are threatening you, and it's scary. And I figured that's not the kind of atmosphere I like. It was a little better at Shea Stadium. But at any rate, if you wanted to write a story about something really scary, you can go up to Yankee Stadium, just stand in the parking lot.
Well, I don't know.
Well, then, girls, it was nice to have a chance to chat with you again after the last year or so. And I hope that we'll be able to do it again, particularly the interested in reading your book about cats.
Soon, I hope.
Soon.
Well, it's all, the text is completed. It's just a question of coordinating the text with the artwork, which is, of course, fairly complicated, can be very complicated.